I was falling. I was hungover. I was not dead. My suit was talking to me. Had been for a bit.
Issue the restraint depressurize command to deflate the restraint system and to commence the next stage of the operation,
suggested a voice in Orth, over and over. Some sewer with good enunciation who'd been drafted to read canned messages into our recording device. I wanted to meet her.
Rosenzel,
I said, thinking that this would impress her. The suit drew breath, then said,
Issue the restraint depressurize command to
Rosenzel,
I insisted. She was beginning to get on my nerves. Maybe I didn't want to meet her after all.
Issue the restraint
restraint depressurize.
The bags deflated.
Welcome to low arb orbit,
said the voice, in an altogether different tone. My head and torso were now free to move about the HTU, but my arms and legs were still taped and foamed. I got busy with that box cutter. It was slow going at first, but soon hunks of foam and snarls of tape were flying out of the Magnifique, drifting away, keeping station in my general vicinity. Eventually, because of their low mass and high drag, they'd re-enter and burn up. Until then, they'd make a lot of visual clutter to confuse the geometers. Speaking of clutter, I was beginning to see brilliant specks of light around me. There were two kinds. Millions of tiny sparkles, strips of chaff sent up on other missiles, and dozens of large, steady beacons. Some of the latter were near enough that my eyeballs, gradually resuming their former shape, could resolve them as disks or moons. Depending on where they, I, and the sun were situated, some looked like full moons, some like new ones, others somewhere in between. There was a half-moon off to my right, steadily getting larger as my orbit and it converged. It was a metallized polyballoon, 500 feet across, sent up in the same missile barrage as I. By measuring its apparent size against the reticle on my face mask, I was able to estimate its distance, about 2 miles. This must be the one I was supposed to make for. Feeling around inside the arm stumps, I got my left hand on the trackball and my right on the stick. They were dead until I uttered another voice command and confirmed it by flicking a switch. This brought the Magnifique's thrusters under my control. Up to now, the built-in guidance system had been managing them. And assuming that the nearby balloon was the one that I was supposed to be aiming for, it seemed to have done a respectable job. But it had no eyes, no brain by which it could home in on the balloon. And as long as the geometers kept jamming our nav satellites, it could only get me so close. From here on, my eyes would have to be the sensors and my brain the guidance system. I gave the trackball the tiniest rotation just to verify that the system was working, and the thrusters spat blue light and spun me around to a new attitude. I got my bearings, squared ARB's horizon below me, figured out which way was southeast, the direction of my orbital travel, made a mental calculation, thought about it one more time for good measure, and gave the joystick a shot in two directions. The Magnifique hit me with a 1-2 punch. Other than that, nothing terrible happened, and I liked what the balloon was now doing in my visual field, so I was tempted to repeat. But I thought better of it. That was how we had frequently got into trouble in the video game, by doing too much of the right thing. I had a long-distance wireless transceiver, for use only in emergencies. I left it switched off. When the balloon was close enough for the short-range system to work, I said, Reticule scan. And a few moments later, the suit came back with, Network joined. Drowned out by Saman's voice,
How was that for a ride?
I want my money back, I said, and suppressed a feeling of wild joy that came over me on hearing his, anyone's voice. Glancing down at a display below my face mask, actually projected into my eyeballs so that it looked that way, I saw icons for myself, Saman, and Fra Gratho. But as I was looking, Esma's face and then Jules were tacked on. I looked around to see two other Magnifiques converging on us. They were flying in improbably close formation. Actually, one of them, Esma, was towing the other.
I grappled Jules. He was drifting,
Esma said. Fortunately, I had grown accustomed to the Veiler's habit of modest understatement. I had only just managed to get here alone. In the same time, Esma had tracked someone else, maneuvered to snag him, and brought him home.
Jules, what's up? You okay? Is this what passes for a joke on La Terre? Saman asked.
I locked him out of the reticule, Esma said. He was speaking incoherently of cheese. 20 minutes to line of sight, said an automated voice, referring to the time when the Dabin Urnud would be able to see us. The balloon now was huge in my vision, and I could see Saman hovering to one side of it in his magnifique, Gratho in his about 50 feet away. Both looked strangely colorful and fuzzy, like toddler's toys. The magnifiques and the other non-human payloads that had been sent up at the same time were surrounded by unruly clouds of fibrous netting that had been crammed into sealed capsules for the ride up, but that had popped open once we had hit orbit and expanded to 10 times their former volume. We looked like drifting red pom-poms. "You guys performed the star check?" I asked.
"Yes," said Gratho. "But I invite you to verify our results."
I used the trackball to nudge myself around until I could see the vaguely circular constellation that outlined the hoplite's shield, and compared its position to those of Arb and of the balloon. This was a simple way of assuring that when our orbit took us around to where telescopes on the Dabin Urnud might be able to see us, the balloon would be between us and them.